Welcome to Occult Experiments in the Home, Magic, Spirituality and the Paranormal, in Personal Experience and in Practice. It was on a Thursday night, July the 9th, 1981. That was the night my life changed forever. And the reason I can date it so precisely is because a record called Ghost Town, released by a band called The Specials, had made it to number one that week, and I was 14 years old, and that record was a big deal to me at the time. The record was playing in the background on the television. But that night, something else unexpectedly had happened, and it had blown my mind so completely that even Ghost Town by The Specials playing on the TV wasn't enough to take my attention away. I had discovered, at that rather vulnerable and tender age, the Ouija board. My sister is 3 years younger than me, and one of her friends was around that evening, and it was this friend who made the suggestion that we should give the Ouija board a try. Now, I'd been interested in strange and spooky things since a very young age. By age 14, I'd read all sorts of books about the paranormal, and I knew full well what a Ouija board was. But in my mind, a Ouija board was a particular object, a product. So if you wanted to use one, you'd have to find one and buy one. And I'd never seen a Ouija board in any kind of shop that I'd visited at that age. It was a complete revelation to me when my sister's friend informed us that to use the Ouija board, you don't need to buy anything. You just write the words yes and no and the letters of the alphabet on some small pieces of paper and arrange them in a circle, put a glass in the middle, put your fingers on the glass, and away you go. It had just never occurred to me, because I'd assumed it was some special property of the product that's packaged as a Ouija board that somehow makes it work. But of course it isn't, and in a way, I suppose my sister's young friend was performing the role of the first chaos magician I ever encountered. So that's what we did that evening. And needless to say, the glass moved. None of us could tell which of us was moving it. My parents were in, and they were keeping an eye on us, but they generally allowed us to be interested in whatever we wanted to be interested in, as long as it wasn't leading to any obvious harm. The messages our homemade Ouija board was spelling out were mostly gibberish. And my mum joined in at one point, and the yes-no answers that we were receiving led her to suggest that the spirit that was communicating with us might be her long-departed Uncle Jack. Uncle Jack was illiterate, as many people of his generation were, and so it seemed that perhaps that trait had persisted after death. That was why the communications were mostly gibberish. Well, there was no stopping me after this point. I became a habitual Ouija board user. And perhaps it was because of the difficulty we had getting coherent messages from the Ouija board, because it always seemed to be illiterate Uncle Jack who insisted on coming through, that we started to suggest that the spirits instead might like to produce material manifestations of their presence, such as knocking instead of moving the glass, or producing motion in objects in the room. Although the spirits pretty much always promised that they would be able to produce phenomena like this, and they would often string us along with excuses for why it wasn't happening, there were a few very rare, very inexplicable occurrences when what we asked for actually happened. And those experiences had a massive impact upon me and have haunted me for decades. Were they hallucinations? Were they false memories? Even if either of those were the case, then I've lived my life ever since as if they had been real. In which case, what is the difference between them being exactly what they appeared to be or being some kind of delusion? There's no difference there at all in practical terms. I'm just going to describe one incident from this particular phase of my life. And my reason for choosing this one is simply because there is a slight degree of corroboration in it because of the way it involves two people. This is how I described it in a passage from my book called Occult Experiments in the Home. One day, my sister came in from school looking scared and beckoned me away from my parents. "Touch the air around my hand," she said. I reached out, and my fingers encountered something peculiar. The space around her arm was alive. It felt vibrant, like static electricity. It gave me that tingling sensation you feel on the surface of a television screen or on a rubber balloon after rubbing it against nylon clothes. But more than that, it was warm. The sweat glands on my hand prickled in response to its heat. "Hot, isn't it?" said my sister. I nodded, but even as she had spoken, the sensation passed, as if my hand had pierced a delicate membrane and destroyed it. I groped in the air around her arm, but couldn't find it again. "It's Grandad," my sister whispered. So, what my sister and her friends had been doing at school that afternoon was to each of them summon a dead relative, and each of these apparent ancestral spirits had manifested as a kind of thermal bangle that they wore around their wrists. And each of them could feel this in the air around the wrists of the others, as indeed I'd felt it around my sister's wrist. I'd felt it without her even having told me that it was there. But we need to pause, I think. Somehow we've found ourselves moving very far, very quickly. We started off with making a Ouija board out of bits of paper and a glass, and now we've ended up evoking spirits directly without any kind of device between them and ourselves, but obtaining instead direct physical manifestations that would appear possibly to possess some kind of objective reality to them. It's this aspect of the Ouija board, I think, that has given it its fearsome reputation, especially in the field of popular culture. The general notion is that using a Ouija board is likely to lead to things getting out of control. Now, in the experiences I had, nobody died, nobody got possessed. But nevertheless, I think one of the lessons I learned in retrospect from these early experiences was that obsession with entities, whatever we suppose their nature to be, and possible harm arising from overindulgence of them, these are ever-present dangers when we're using the Ouija board. What I want to focus on in this episode is, what is this magical method or process that we call Ouija, and how is it that it produces the effects that it does? When we think about other common items of magical equipment, such as tarot cards or scrying mirrors or pendulums, None of them, I think, has quite the fearsome reputation that the Ouija board has. So what's different about the Ouija board? And does it really have a place in our magic? Most magical devices have a particular system associated with them, and that's what gives them their nature. These systems vary in all kinds of different ways. If you go to a store and buy a pack of tarot cards, you're not going to be able to start doing readings straight away. You have to get to understand that system that is the tarot, immerse yourself in its symbolism and absorb its meanings. And the same applies pretty much to the runes, but it's not quite the case, perhaps, with the Yi Qing. The Yi Qing takes the form of a book, and what you have to do there is to master a method of consulting that book, whether it's tossing coins or casting yarrow sticks. Once you employ that method, then you don't really need to understand the symbolism of the Yi Qing in the way that you need to understand the tarot and the runes. You're simply directed to the passage in the book that gives you the answer to your question. All of these methods of divination have a system associated with them, whereas I think it's pretty clear that in the case of the Ouija board, there's not really very much that could be considered a system at all. There's just language. You don't have to learn or immerse yourself in any symbols or cultural trappings at all. However, when we consult one of the classical oracles, we know that we're talking to that oracle. When we select a rune from the bag, for instance, we know that the answer that we're getting is coming from the runes. The message from the Ouija board, however, is just coming in the form of everyday language. We know what the message is saying, but it's left entirely up to us to establish where it might be that that message is coming from. So what characterizes the Ouija board as a magical device is its complete openness. Or another way of describing it might be to say it's incredibly leaky from a magical perspective. Is the Ouija board divination, finding out about things, or is it evocation, summoning spirits? Well, of course, it's got to be a mixture of both, hasn't it? But because it's a mixture, we're confronted with the problem not only of understanding what the message means, which is the problem we have when we're using an oracle like the tarot, but the additional problem of then having to somehow ascertain whether the message is coming from a source that's trustworthy. Oracles like the tarot, the runes, the Yi Qing, we can trust because of the wisdom that's embedded in those ancient systems that have stood the test of time. But there's no wisdom at all necessarily embedded in communications we receive from the Ouija board. If they have any wisdom at all, it's presumably coming from whatever entity we suppose is delivering the communication. Now, the Ouija board is not alone in being a magical device or system that blurs the lines between divination and evocation. The pendulum, for instance, is often used in a way that's very clearly a combination of both. And another recent and very interesting example is Tommy Kelly's 40 Servants card deck. This is a collection of very carefully chosen and rendered images of archetypal figures. And they can be used either in a symbolic divinatory way, pretty much as you might use a deck of tarot cards to give communications or answers to a specific question. But also you can choose specific cards and evoke or invoke the archetypal characters depicted on them. Summon them, in other words, for use in whatever magical activities the magician chooses. In my view, there's nothing wrong or unique in this mixing of divination and evocation. But, of course, when you're working with the 40 Servants deck, you know exactly which of the entities you're dealing with at any time. And when you're using a pendulum, the range of responses from the pendulum is usually pretty limited. Usually yes, no, and maybe. So when you're using a pendulum, it's a pretty easy matter to stay in control of the communication and direct it where you want it to go. If there are things that you don't want to know about, then you simply don't ask that question. In contrast, the Ouija board is not restrained or locked down in any of these ways. It's, again, completely wide open. In principle, anything at any time could tell you absolutely anything that it wanted to. So, is the Ouija board evil? I think you could make that argument if you wanted to. Personally, I would want to nuance that a little bit and say instead that the Ouija board, as a device, has certain characteristics that make it volatile to use. And it's left completely up to the operator to decide whether that communication is filtered or boundaried in any way. But before we start to explore why that might be a good idea and how you might go about doing that, again, we need to back up a little bit, maybe. Because for a lot of people, understandably, the very idea that on the other end of a Ouija board somehow is some kind of entity, this idea is somewhat problematic. Back in 1852, an English physician named William Benjamin Carpenter published a paper setting out an idea that turned into what is now known as the ideomotor effect. This is the phenomenon whereby ideas or thoughts in the mind of a person seem to lead to that person making physical movements, but without them being aware that they're having ideas and thoughts that are prompting them to make those movements. In 1852, the notion of there being an unconscious mind was something that was still taking shape, and Carpenter was one of the pioneers in that respect at this time. In his paper, he points out how we're all perfectly familiar with our conscious will leading to us deciding to make certain movements. But we're also familiar with how we can be made to make involuntary bodily movements by emotions, for instance. If we're suddenly overcome with a strong emotion, we might sink to our knees completely involuntarily. Or strong physical sensations of hot and cold can make us react bodily without even thinking about it. Or seeing something scary and dangerous, perceiving something, can send us running away before we've even consciously recognise what it is. Carpenter was the first to suggest that it's not just intentions, emotions, sensations and perceptions that can cause us to make bodily movements without us even being aware at the time, but also thoughts and ideas. Thus, the ideomotor principle of action, he wrote, finds its appropriate place in the physiological scale, which would indeed be incomplete without it. And, when it is once recognised, it may be applied to the explanation of numerous phenomena which have been a source of perplexity to many who have been convinced of their genuineness and who could not see any mode of reconciling them with the known laws of nervous action. The phenomena in question are those which have been recently set down to the action of an owed force, such, for example, as the movements of the divining rod and the vibration of bodies suspended from the finger, in other words, dowsing rods and pendulums, both of which have been clearly proved to depend on the state of expectant attention on the part of the performer, his will being temporarily withdrawn from control over his muscles by the state of abstraction to which his mind is given up, and the anticipation of a given result being the stimulus which, directly and involuntarily, prompts the muscular movements that produce it. In other words, there's nothing paranormal happening when folks use pendulums or dowsing rods or Ouija boards. There's no spooky owed force, as it was called back in the day. There are simply unconscious thoughts or ideas in the mind of a person, and it's these which are prompting them to make movements without them being aware of it. And this idea of the ideomotor reflex has been used ever since as a way of explaining what's happening when we're using the Ouija board, not in terms of contact with entities of any description, but merely the unconscious thoughts of the operators themselves finding expression through the Ouija board. I think even from the first time I ever used one, I wasn't really in any doubt that one or more of the people using the Ouija board are moving the glass or planchette without themselves being aware of it. One of the very first experiments I made when I was 14 was to see what happened when everyone took their fingers off the glass. And of course, it immediately stops moving. Others might have had different experiences, but I've never ever experienced the glass moving around on its own. I don't think it's the question of whether it's the operator moving the glass that separates the scientist and the magician, but rather the significance that it's appropriate to allocate to that. Okay, so there are unconscious ideas or thoughts prompting us to push the glass around. There's nothing in dispute there. But what is that unconscious thought? And how was that unconscious thought arrived at? In other words, what is the style of thinking that this unconscious thinker has? This is the dimension that the magician investigates. I think the example of the dowsing rod illustrates it most dramatically. Okay, so there's no paranormal force at work here. It's merely the muscular power of the operator, the dowser. But providing it's the case, and it tends to be more often than not, the dowser's muscles are reacting when he or she is standing over water. Yes, it's an unconscious process. But if the dowser could find water consciously, he or she wouldn't need to douse. In other words, an unconscious idea or thought process raises the possibility that it's not simply more of the same. If my conscious mind thinks differently from my unconscious mind, then who can really say with certainty that my unconscious is not actually a separate, different mind? This was how I put it in my book, Occult Experiments in the Home. Which was more bizarre? Uncle Jack steering the glass, or this unnameable other working us like meat puppets without our permission? I remember after I'd submitted it for publication, the copy editor questioned whether I really wanted to use that expression, meat puppet. He found it really horrible, really disturbing. But I insisted on it being left in because it is a weird and unsettling idea. We have unconscious thoughts and ideas. How did they get there? How do we know there isn't something or somebody putting them into us? If we're not aware of them, how do we know they're ours? The ideomotor reflex is very commonly trotted out as an explanation for the Ouija board, but this can also be seen as a classic attempt at explaining away. The ideomotor reflex actually raises further and very deep questions about the nature of subjectivity and the separation of minds. It seems it's very hard to make these kinds of questions go away. I came across a fairly recent research paper on the Ouija board, published in 2018. I'll put the reference in the notes. Here, very interestingly, the experimenters set up a situation where people were using a Ouija board in pairs, and they'd rigged up each of the set of pairs with eye-tracking devices, equipment that reveals where somebody is looking as they're using the Ouija board. What this revealed was that when folks are using the Ouija board, they really do seem unable to tell where the glass or the planchette is going. The eye-tracking devices showed that more often than the experimenters had seemed to expect, the participants weren't looking at the letter where the planchette was ending up. As the experimenters themselves ask in the paper, how can participants on the one hand produce coherent and meaningful responses through the board, while on the other hand be unable to predict those very same responses? So once again, this idea that of course the participants are pushing the planchette, but at the same time it being apparent that they really truly don't know where that planchette is going. So how is it being determined where that planchette ends up? What the experimenters did next, however, was to investigate how well the letter that the planchette arrived at was being predicted, not at the level of the individual participants, but at the level of the pair. So, in effect, looking to see whether, if one of the pair was looking at the wrong letter, was the other one looking at the right letter? And what they found was, yes, as a pair, the eye tracker showed that far more correct predictions were taking place and were increasing over time as the pair continued to communicate with the Ouija board. It seems that meaningful responses from the Ouija board, they concluded, are an emergent property of interacting predictive minds that increasingly impose structure on initially random events in the sessions. So, although as individuals, the users of a Ouija board don't seem to know where the planchette is going, apparently, as a group, they seem to have a better grasp. The experimenters felt that they'd reached a possible solution for the tricky question of how the Ouija board produces meaningful responses, even when it's clear that the people using the board are totally unconscious of where they're steering the planchette to. But personally, yet again, despite that fashionable scientific term, emergent property, I find myself wondering if there aren't yet deeper questions here, and another attempt at explaining away. Because if we suppose that the communication from the Ouija board is coming from some kind of group mind, some kind of amalgamation of the thinking of all the participants, then whose unconscious is that coming from exactly? Somebody's or nobody's or everybody's? Or if it's from a part of the unconscious of every participant in the session, could it be the case that the whole is maybe different from the sum of the parts? Those endless proliferating questions about where one mind might end and another one begin. It seems these just won't go away. Another strand in the research of this paper has to do with a concept described as sense of agency. The experimenters discovered that those participants who were less good at predicting where the planchette would end up reported feeling as if they had less of a sense of agency when using the Ouija board than those more successful at predicting the outcome. And also there was a correlation between a low sense of agency and people who reported themselves as believers that the Ouija board could be used to contact supernatural paranormal entities. In the paper, the experimenters mention how low sense of agency has also been correlated with pathological conditions such as psychosis and criminality. Low sense of agency is definitely being given a connotation here as something potentially quite negative. It seems to be a prerequisite, however, for having an experience of communicating with supernatural and paranormal entities. I'm not recommending it, but merely to highlight here how cultivation of low sense of agency could be potentially a magical technique, but not one without significant risks and dangers, as the apparent link with psychosis and criminality hopefully makes clear. And if using a Ouija board perhaps cultivates or encourages a reduced sense of agency, then maybe that's another reason for the reputation it has, for destabilizing people and creating potentially very disturbing effects. What we're calling sense of agency here is maybe the crucial component in using the Ouija board as a magical tool, effectively and to the degree that we can, safely. We want to loosen and reduce that sense of agency enough that we gain the experience of being in communication with some kind of independent entity, whatever we decide that entity to be. But at the same time, we don't want to relinquish that sense of agency too much to the point that we don't have any control whatsoever over the entity and therefore it calls the shots and ends up doing with us whatever it likes. This is what Aleister Crowley said about the Ouija board in a very short little article he wrote that was published in 1917. Suppose a perfect stranger came into your office and proceeded to give orders to your staff. Suppose a strange woman walked into your drawing room and insisted on being hostess. You would be troubled by this. Yet, people sit down and offer the use of their brains and hands, which are, after all, more important than offices and drawing rooms, to any stray intelligences that may be wandering about. People use the Ouija board without taking the slightest precautions. In what he goes on to say about the Ouija board, there's very much a sense that for Crowley, the Ouija has its place in magic. There is a good way of using this instrument to get what you want, he writes, and that is to perform the whole operation in a consecrated circle, so that undesirable aliens cannot interfere with it. You should then employ the proper magical invocation in order to get into your circle just the one spirit that you want. It is comparatively easy to do this. A few simple instructions are all that is necessary, and I should be pleased to give these, free of charge, to anyone who cares to apply. He's having a bit of a joke there, of course. But I think he's right. I think when it comes to using the Ouija board, a bit of magical knowledge and experience is very useful as a means of preventing things from getting out of hand. In other words, losing that sense of agency that we explored earlier. The techniques of magic can help to filter and structure that encounter, to lock it down and retain a certain modicum of a sense of agency that enables us to stay safe, or relatively safe anyway. In 2011, I organised a group magical working to evoke and communicate with a djinni. The djinn, of course, are non-human beings described in Islamic tradition. Unlike human beings, which are made of solid matter, the djinn are believed to consist of smokeless fire. Their bodies are supposedly composed of matter that's in a more fluid and excitable state than ours, a kind of plasma maybe. And whereas to the Western mind, phenomena such as ghosts, fairies, grey aliens, Bigfoot, all seem to be different kinds of things, in Islamic cultures, there would probably be a greater tendency to view all of those as manifestations of the jinn. Having read a little bit about them, I was keen to see if it was possible to connect with them and experience, perhaps, their nature a little bit more directly. So I adapted what was supposedly some kind of traditional ritual for summoning a djinni that I'd seen copied in various places around the internet, and planned to use this in conjunction with the Ouija board for actually communicating with the entity. For good measure, I also threw in a ghost box, which is basically a small portable radio that's been physically modified so that it can't lock on to any particular frequency but is constantly scanning through all of its frequencies, relaying just little momentary snippets of broadcasts as it scans through, which creates a kind of random melange of sound through which an entity can be invited to manifest vocally. But also, importantly, the djinn are known to often be quite hostile towards human beings. So I decided to put the Ouija board and everybody participating in the ritual within a protective circle. And the ghost box and the other means of manifestation that we were using, a black mirror, we placed in a triangle, a shape that in Western magic is traditionally used for constraining spirits. And the triangle was positioned at a distance outside the protective circle. The idea was that we were evoking the djinni into the triangle, and once it was in there, it would be constrained and wouldn't be able to get out. And meanwhile, all of us participants would be safely protected within the circle, as long as we didn't step outside of that circle. A number of interesting things happened during this working. We performed the evocation, and so, ostensibly, the djinni was now constrained within the triangle. As soon as we asked the first question, however, the ghost box stopped working. instead of scanning randomly, it suddenly locked onto a local news channel. Now, this is odd because the ghost box was created by taking a transistor radio and physically removing one of its components. With this component removed, supposedly it was impossible for it to lock on to any channel, but somehow it had. Not only was this puzzling, it was also incredibly annoying, because we're trying to question the genie and now we've got the local news blaring out of the triangle. But all of us were experienced magicians and none of us were going to be fooled into stepping outside the circle and going into the triangle to turn off the ghost box or attempt to fix it. So here, I hope, is an example of how magical protocols can be used. Doing the ritual and using the Ouija board lowers the sense of agency enough for us to have an experience of a genie being in the triangle. But at the same time, having the triangle and the protective circle retains enough sense of agency to prevent things from feeling as if they're totally out of control. My experience of using the Ouija board has been that most of the spirits or entities we connect with apparently have very low intelligence and seem intent mostly on wasting time and attracting human attention to no very constructive end. But occasionally, just occasionally, I've had a different experience. And this ritual with the genie was one of those experiences. What we did first of all was to use the Ouija board to get answers to a couple of questions to ascertain that the entity was what it said it was. The ritual I'd used for invoking the genie was designed specifically to invoke a male genie. Nobody else was aware of this. My hand was not on the planchette when I asked these questions, but when we asked the genie its sex, the planchette moved immediately to M for male. Well, of course, it had a 50% chance of getting that right, so the next question I asked was, what was the first letter of the name of the leader of the djinn? Now, none of the other participants had been reading up on djinn lore, and they hadn't even been aware that I was bringing the ritual that day. And even though nobody with their hand on the planchette knew the answer to this question, the planchette moved directly to the letter I. I for the name Iblis, which is the correct answer to the question. I found that this sort of thing is also a useful tactic when dealing with the Ouija board. If the answer for a specific question is a known word, then just ask for the first letter of that word. There are two advantages to this, I think. First, it's quicker just to get one letter. But also, it doesn't give the entity the opportunity to mess around, to string you along by giving vague responses. Another tactic is when the Ouija board says it's going to give an answer to a specific question, to ask it how many letters are going to be in that answer. That's another way of ensuring that it sticks to the point and is prevented from finding ways to waste time and attention. Because of all these extra protocols and filters, which are really, I think, just good magical hygiene, the results gained from that working were actually pretty impressive. At one point, we asked the genie to produce knocking sounds, and we even managed to pick up on the microphone a strange noise in reply. This was interesting, but the environment wasn't really controlled enough to completely rule out mundane causes for that. There's a book by J. Edward Cornelius called Alistair Crowley and the Ouija Board. It came out in 2005. And what he's doing in that book, you could say, perhaps, is taking that short essay by Crowley that we looked at, the essay in which Crowley promises to explain for free to anyone who applies how to use the Ouija board in a safer way, and actually expanding on that and giving that advice that Crowley probably would have given. The following passage from Cornelius's book, I think, really gives a sense, a flavour of the mindset, the magical mindset that's required to interact successfully and as safely as you can with the Ouija board. Cornelius has imagined a scenario in which we're communicating with a spirit through the Ouija, a spirit that we've called into a triangle of our hut, whilst we ourselves are safely within a protective circle. But he's illustrating that even this, perhaps, is not going to be sufficient. And a certain very boundaried approach to the spirit is still required. This is what he writes. If you consciously ask if the bumps, creaks, and noises which you hear around your house are him, i.e. the spirit in the triangle, and he answers yes, then you've acknowledged him free of the triangle and have allowed him to escape. On the other hand, it is okay to ask how he is creating the noises when confined within the triangle and express this aspect strongly. He may try to trick you with answers such as, I am not bound within the triangle, but this is not true. Instead, command him to remain within the triangle and do it forcibly. Then change the subject and move the topic into another area of thought. His abilities do in fact allow him to create noises or reactions outside the triangle, both during a ritual and at other times. But these are all temporary manifestations. It's only logical that if an entity standing outside the circle is able to move the triangle, he is also capable of moving objects and creating noises around the house, especially in those areas not confined within the circle. There are quite a few tactics and techniques on display in that passage, perhaps. And again, the concept of sense of agency is useful in understanding how those are working and what's going on there. So the occurrence of weird noises in the house is creating the sense of the presence of an entity, reducing our sense of agency in the way that the noises are seeming to take on an independent existence of their own. But Cornelius points out how if we ask the wrong question, use the wrong language, then we end up giving too much of the sense of agency away to the entity. If we say, is that you making those noises upstairs? Then, as Cornelius says, we're admitting that the entity is loose from the triangle. But if we shift that question slightly to how are you making those noises, then the entity's still in the triangle, even though the noises are being made. What Cornelius seems to be putting on display here is how it's not really sufficient to summon an entity by saying, I now summon you to appear in the triangle, and assuming that that's it. He's showing how that act of will needs to be applied constantly throughout the working. The language we use, the questions we ask, our mental image and our conception of the entity, because after all, this isn't something with a material form. It's something that, to the extent that it exists at all, it exists mentally in the imagination. And so the way that we imagine it and conceive it is the form that it's going to take. Consequently, we have to keep thinking and keep imagining the entity in the right way. As soon as we've inadvertently bought into a notion that there's something roaming around freely in our house making noises, then that's what we'll be experiencing, that's what will be happening, and we will have surrendered that sense of agency too far. It's a tricky thing to do, it's a tricky thing to stay on top of, it's an art, a skill. The ideomotor reflex is indeed connecting us with unconscious ideas, unconscious trains of thought. But as we've seen, merely labelling those unconscious doesn't do away with their mystery. The mystery of where they might come from, how they got there, and whether to some degree they are separate from us. But as this passage from Cornelius's book demonstrates, I think, we call upon our conscious will, our conscious use of language and imagination in order to counteract that unconscious mystery with the force of conscious awareness, which can help prevent that sense of agency from slipping away too much to a dangerous extent. That's it for this episode. As ever, I don't recommend that you try the things talked about here, for the simple reason that they can't be guaranteed as free from harm. But I hope the ideas and the lines of thinking here provide some pointers for how someone might go about practicing the use of the Ouija board as safely as it can be used. As ever, it's thanks to supporters on Patreon that this podcast appears from week to week. So if you're interested in supporting it and gaining access to extra material, just pop along to patreon.com/OEITH. And there's also information in the notes about how you can make a one-off donation if you found this episode useful or any of the others, as well as a link to where you might like to buy me a lovely book instead. And many thanks to Rob who did that. That's really lovely of you, Rob, and very much appreciated. Thank you. So, look after yourself. Don't forget your protective circle and your triangle of art. And hopefully we'll speak again soon. Take care. Bye-bye.